Hi there, and welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Before we are going to tune in to our program with Ralph Ellis, we are going to talk a little bit about the upcoming Beyond Knowledge conference in Liverpool, England. And we have Dave Truman, the man behind the conference, with us on the line here today to give us a few details and also talk a little bit about the speakers that we'll be attending. And this is going to be a very fun event and interesting also. So it's good to have Dave with us today to tell us more about it. Hi, Dave. Good to have you with us.
Oh, hello. Hi.
Excellent. You know, I'd love to know a little bit more about the conference. So if you will, give us a little bit of overview, if you will, when, where, how, and so on.
Yes, it's a Beyond Knowledge conference. It's what we're calling it, an international esoteric science conference, and it's taking place in Liverpool on the 3rd and the 4th of May this year, which is a little less than a month's time from now.
And tell us a little bit about some of the speakers that will be attending the conference.
Yeah, well, we have Michael Tesarian coming to speak, Ralph Ellis, who you've already mentioned, and various people as well from the United States. Ken Thomas is coming, who is the founder of Steam Shovel Press and publishes Paranoia magazine in the States. David Hatcher Childress, who's a friend of mine, he's coming to speak on Atlantis and the ancient power system of the gods. David Griffin is coming. He's from the UK. He heads up Exopolitics UK, the UK branch of Exopolitics. We also have Ian R. Crane, who was involved with the 9/11 truth movement in Britain. But he talks, he's a wonderful speaker, and he's going to be talking on a wide range of topics, linking them together.
Any activities, so to speak, between speakers? What's going to happen there, Dave? Tell us about it.
Yes, well, in the evening we are going to have some music from local musicians who want to come along and play. So there'll be entertainment in the evening for people attending the conference. And that will also give people a chance to mingle and sort of swap ideas and get to know each other as well, because it isn't just about being talked at by the speakers. I think everybody wants to be able to share things. In addition to that, my shop, Urban Myths in Liverpool, will have a stall there selling books and other resources, as well as an Adventures Unlimited Press store in the conference. And there will be also other artists and local craft shops, independent traders, who will be selling their wares and goods as well, many of which will be of interest to the people attending the conference, I'm sure.
The particular speakers that you did invite, there's a kind of a connection between them, or how did this come together, so to speak?
Yes, I mean, it was almost by a process of serendipity that the conference came together, actually. It started, actually, we've also got Jerry E. Smith, sorry for forgetting about him. It started when I was exchanging emails with Jerry, and he asked me if I knew of any good conferences in the UK that he could speak at, because he'd just published his latest book, Weather Wars,
right.
Weather Warfare. And I'd made a few inquiries, and everybody was booked up in advance. So I said half-jokingly to him that perhaps, you know, we could run our own conference.
Right, right.
And then the whole thing started to snowball from there. I was already communicating with Michael Tesarian, because I have a lot of people who come in my shop, which is called Urban Myths in Liverpool, asking for Michael's books and materials.
Right.
So I basically asked him, and then he asked me if, you know, he knew, if I knew of any good conferences in the UK. So I thought, well, there's two speakers to start with. And I knew David Childress already, and he was willing to get involved, and he was coming to the UK anyway at that time. And so the whole thing just really took off from there.
Very good. And have there been any, or are there any similar events in the Liverpool area?
No. I mean, this is unique, really. This is the first time that anything has happened, certainly in the Liverpool area,
right.
For many, many years, with this kind of, or these kinds of subjects, and with this caliber of speakers.
So, people that are interested in attending the conference, tell us a little bit about where people can buy tickets and also exactly where it's going to be and how people can get there and so forth.
Right, yes. Well, the conference is going to be in the Sefton Park district of Liverpool, which is south of the city. It's about 3 miles from the city centre, but it's very easy to get to by train and bus and so on. And you can buy tickets either by going online and going to the conference website. The address of that is www.beyond-knowledge.co.uk, and you can buy your tickets online there. Or, if you want to, you can telephone this phone number and order online at my shop. The number is 44, which is the code for the UK, 151-708-9859. Alternatively, you can write to me at my P.O. Box address, which is P.O. Box 1257, Liverpool L691AJ.
Take the address again and also the phone number again for people.
Yes. The telephone number is 44, which is the international code for the UK, 151-708-9859. And the P.O. Box address is P.O. Box 1257, Liverpool L691AJ.
Brilliant. And also, again, the website there is beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Yes. And are there like places nearby that people can hook up that want to stay for the entire
yes.
event?
Yes. Mm-hmm. If you go to the website, there's a comprehensive list of local hotels and guest houses, bed and breakfasts, and other accommodation in the area. There's also a link through to the Liverpool Accommodation and Booking Services. So they will find you a room if all of the local hotels in the immediate area are booked up.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And also, of course, all the details on the schedule and so forth is on your website, right? So people can...
Everything is on the website, yes. Mm-hmm. I've had to do this almost single-handedly up until now. I have a few friends helping me. Mm-hmm. So I've had to use the website, really, as a means of cutting down on sort of writing letters to people and printing out lots of documents.
Absolutely. And what is it now? It's only about 1, 2, 3 weeks, something like that left. So would you encourage...
Yes, it's just over 3 weeks away. So ticket sales are really speeding up at the moment.
They are,
so
yeah,
if
yeah.
people are interested and they want to come, I advise them to book in advance.
Exactly. Yeah, very good. So you can have a chance to come over there and see some of these nice speakers that will be attending. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's going to be nice. Myself and Fredrik, of course, are going to be over there too. So it's going to be very nice hooking up with you guys over there. It's going to be
indeed,
lots of
yes.
fun.
I'm yeah. looking forward to meeting you both.
Definitely. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention regarding the conference or that people should know that want to attend?
I think it's going to be a very interesting day. And we hope, all of us who are now involved with planning and organizing it, that this will be the first of... maybe a series of events.
Nice.
We're doing this because we think that this kind of knowledge should be disseminated and spread more widely. And we all think that we're going through a sort of waking up period in the history of the Earth at the moment.
Right.
And this is really, I suppose, our small contribution to that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's, as far as I know, there aren't that many of these kinds of events, you know, either in Britain or for Europe, for that matter. It seems to be very, you know, active in America, of course, but it's very nice to see some of this popping up in Europe, and that's why we want to also highlight this and encourage this on our program, you know?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
One more time, Dave, give us the website address so people can find all the details.
Yes, it's www.beyond-knowledge.co, that's .co, .uk.
Brilliant. Okay, so with that, thank you very much, Dave, for coming on and sharing that with us. And again, I'm looking forward to very much hooking up with you guys. It's again the 3rd to the 4th of May, so we'll be seeing you there.
Okay, and thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much, Dave. Up next on the program, we have Ralph Ellis. Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Good to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in. We are recording this program from Sweden in Scandinavia, but wherever you are around the world, you can find us online at our website, redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Glad to have you here. Hope you're settled in for an interesting program. We have scholar, author, and researcher Ralph Ellis back with us on the program today. Ralph has a new book coming out in April called King Jesus, From Cam, Egypt to Camelot. And this book resolves the biggest secret and international conspiracy of all time, the true origins of Christianity, that King Jesus of Judea was King Arthur of England. And Ralph is always looking into new and controversial areas, and his research is brilliant, so this is going to be fascinating diving into this subject here today. The website that you can take a look at, Ralph's website, is edfu-books.com, edfu-books.com, where you can read much more and get a hold of Ralph's latest and previous books. Ralph is also going to attend the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool, England, at the beginning of May, and we'll talk much more about that later, so do stick around. So, it's a pleasure having you back on the program, Ralph. Thank you for coming on again.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Good to have you with us. And, you know, let's dive into it right away and get a little bit of background, I guess, on this story, Ralph. King Jesus and King Arthur, were they the one and the same? If you look at some of the mythology, of course, there are certainly hints leading in this direction. And Ralph, was it the case that you first set out to confirm that St. Paul, or Saul, actually was Josephus Flavius, but in the process a much bigger story opened up?
Yes, it did. It was quite a development. I was writing a book on St. Paul, or Saul, as he's known in the New Testament, which is interesting in itself. I'm trying to find the historical person called Saul. You know, who was he really in the historical record? Because, I mean, this is important because this is the guy who created Christianity. Of course, Christianity has nothing to do with Jesus at all. It was a creation by Saul, or St. Paul, about the life of Jesus, but it was actually written by Saul. So this is a very important person. He created Christianity single-handed. And so I was researching his historical past, who he could be in the historical record. Mm. And I've confirmed to my satisfaction that he was indeed Saul. He was Josephus Flavius, the historian.
Well, I mean, that's opens up a can of worms, because so much of the references today, you know, the external, not from the biblical sources itself,
yes,
comes from Josephus, you know?
Yes, that's right. All of the historical sources about the first century, about sort of the events that sort of circumnavigated around the New Testament, were all written by Josephus Flavius. And so to find that this same chap was, in fact, Saul as well, that's St. Paul, and that he wrote or was the editor behind the Gospels and also behind the Pauline letters, you know, the epistles that form the bulk of the New Testament.
Mm.
Yes, as you say, that's quite a development, because it gives us a historical look at who this guy was and what his goals were. And, of course, Josephus was not a very nice character, really.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Jewish traitor. He worked for the Romans. He was very vainglorious, egotistical. He only ever worked for himself, and he only ever tried to portray himself in the best of light. So he was not exactly the best of characters to be writing the New Testament.
So, I mean, what was his motives in regards to this, then?
He was cheated out of... I'm under the impression, having researched this a great deal, that he was actually related to Jesus. These were all important characters, of course. Let's get aside this idea that Jesus was a carpenter.
Right.
He was a king, and he was the high priest of Jerusalem. And in fact, the letters of Saul make it abundantly clear that he became high priest of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So these were important characters, and I think that Saul Josephus was actually related to the same family. Now, he lost out. There was an election. He lost out. He was not voted, because they didn't trust him, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Just as it says in the New Testament that they did not trust Saul. And so he lost his position. He was scorned. And he basically wanted to get his own back. So he didn't get the support of Jesus and James. So he went to Vespasian instead.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to the Romans and got their support. And so he led a counter-revolution against the revolutionaries, Jesus and James being the revolutionaries, using the Romans as his private sort of army.
Hmm.
And of course he won. So yes, it puts a rather different spin on the New Testament story.
It definitely does. And I mean, what would you say is the main motive for kind of embedding the story like this? Meaning, what I'm talking about here is the fact that, you know, Jesus, as you said, was just a poor, you know, a carpenter, everyday man, so to speak. But a matter of fact, what you have found here is that these are kings. You know, they have armies at their disposal, so to speak. But why embed the story in a totally different light, so to speak?
Because it gives it's a much easier story to sell. Yeah, you look at every fairy story in the world for children, and it's always about some pauper who rises to become a prince or a king,
right,
or queen. You know, Cinderella's and all these stories. It's all about people who start from lowly beginnings and become very important. It's an easy story to sell. It's a sob story.
Mm.
And I think this was the reason for it.
But I mean, wouldn't they kind of, if you know what I'm saying, getting trouble along the way? Because at that time, there should have been people around knowing what actually had, you know, been going on and try to, you know, counter this information and say, no, this was actually not what was going on.
Oh, yes. There was. I mean, the Talmud clearly says that. You know, the Talmud makes that perfectly clear. So there were counter stories. But remember, when it came to the Council of Nicaea in what was it, 325 AD?
Right.
Under Constantine. Of course, any of those stories that countered the New Testament story could easily be deleted, and they were. So, I mean, if you read the Talmud, the Talmud says that Scripture says that you shall not spare, nor you shall you conceal the revolutionary, basically.
Mm-hmm.
However, it goes on to say, with Jesus the Nazarene, it was different, for he was connected with the government and with royalty.
There we go.
So you get all along through the Talmud, if you read the Talmud, you get these hints that they were of the royalty.
Right.
For instance, it says of Mary of Bethany. I don't know if you know Mary of Bethany from the lady who anointed Jesus,
right,
as king. Well, that was actually Mary Magdalene. It's quite clear that was Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
But the Talmud says, of course, that this Mary, that's Mary Magdalene, was the richest woman in Judea.
Yeah.
Now, again, there's a bit of a difference, isn't there, between what we are led to believe and what the Talmud actually says.
Exactly.
She was the daughter of Simon of Bothus. And, of course, the Mary and Martha lived in the house of Simon, so it's the same story.
Hmm.
And the Talmud is quite clear that Simon of Bothus was the richest man in Judea. Between him and his two partners, they boasted that they could keep Jerusalem under siege. They could keep Jerusalem going for 10 years.
Hmm. Really? So these are very wealthy. They're merchants. They have a lot of people at their disposal, so to speak, and in many cases kings also. I mean,
yeah.
What I want to ask you is does this new book of yours here, King Jesus, does this pick up from where your previous book, so to speak, left off, the Jesus, the last of the pharaohs, and that
yes.
he was, you know, grand.
It actually picks up, well, it picks up on Jesus, last of the pharaohs. Jesus, last of the pharaohs was a book that gave an overview of the position.
Right.
And it basically was saying that Jesus was an Egyptian prince, in exile, of course, but he was most definitely related somehow to the Egyptian royal line.
Yeah.
But I didn't know where. And then that was continued with the book called Cleopatra to Christ.
Right.
And that made it quite clear that Jesus was actually related to Queen Cleopatra.
Hmm.
He was the great-grandson of Queen Cleopatra. And that comes through a long-lost story, again from Josephus, about a strange queen who was queen of Persia. Now, we don't exactly know who this queen was, but she was given to the king of Persia, Phraates IV, by Octavian, Augustus,
mm.
the Roman emperor. Now, it says in Josephus that that she was a prostitute. However, you would not give as a diplomatic present a prostitute to a foreign king,
mm.
not unless you wanted to provoke a war, of course. but this so-called prostitute was so inspired by the king of Persia that he made her his chief wife, and her son became king of Persia.
Mm.
Quite clear that this woman was very, very important, and if you trace the history back, it does appear that she was the daughter of Queen Cleopatra.
Mm.
Because Augustus had already done this with Cleopatra's other daughter, that was Cleopatra Selene, who was the other daughter of Cleopatra, and she was given to another king, this time Juba II of Mauritania.
Right.
So he was giving diplomatic brides away to the kings on his boundaries that he obviously liked or wanted to keep sweet.
Mm.
And well, this was a daughter of Queen Cleopatra. However, this particular queen, although she became queen of Persia, she did upset the locals and she was kicked out of Persia. The Queen of Persia and her son, some 200 courtiers and a whole army, were exiled to the borders of Syria and Persia. So they were on the borders right between the two, between Judea and Persia, and they were exiled in AD 4. So this is exactly the same time as the New Testament says that obviously Jesus was born, and the whole of the New Testament story starts.
Right, right. But
of course, if we look into the New Testament, the birth of Jesus was accompanied by the three wise men. And the three wise men, of course, were the Magi, the yeah. Magi from Persia. Now, the Magi were actually the Persian priesthood and the Persian kingmakers as well. So why were the Persians interested in a supposedly, you know, Jewish carpenter born in Judea?
Mm-hmm.
The New Testament doesn't make that clear at all. But of course, if we have this new history, then it makes perfect sense, because this family, this child, was a child of an Egyptian mother. She was a daughter a granddaughter of Cleopatra. And she was also half Persian.
Right.
Phraates IV, because she was married to, or her mother had been married to Phraates IV of Persia.
And was her father also Julius Caesar then, the Roman Empire emperor?
Yes. Well, that's yes, the lady we're talking about was the daughter of Cleopatra, and her father was Julius Caesar.
Right.
Now, this is not explicitly given in the Roman record, but it is recorded that when Cleopatra fled Rome on the death of Julius Caesar,
mm.
that she was pregnant. And there was a great flurry of alarm within Rome at the time. because the last thing they wanted was an Egyptian prince to become king, as it were, of Rome.
Right.
And so they were all upset by this, and there was a great kerfuffle. And finally, after several months, the issue died down, the alarm died down. And the question is, why did it do that? And, you know, this pregnancy is never mentioned again.
Really?
Now, the obvious reason for you know, this problem ending itself was the child was not a boy. Under Roman law, you could only become emperor, of course, if you were male.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so if this child had been born female, then the problem had solved itself. And so it seems likely that Cleopatra actually had another child by Julius Caesar. And this was the young princess who was eventually sent to Persia by Augustus Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
About 20 years later or so, as a diplomatic bride, because he wanted to ease tensions with Phraates IV of Persia. So this had to be a very special bride, otherwise he would not have eased the tensions between the two empires.
Mm.
And the most suitable diplomatic bride, of course, would have been a daughter of Cleopatra.
Cleopatra, right, right.
And this is why I say that this particular lady, and her name is Thea Musa Aurania.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I say that she was the lost daughter of Cleopatra and Julius Caesar.
Right.
And this is the lady that gets thrown out of Persia some 20 years later, in her 40s, in AD 4, and sets up a new city-state, pretty much, on the borders of Judea and Syria. Now, this city-state that she set up was called Aurania, and it's still called that now, actually.
Really?
After her name, because her name was Thea Musa Aurania.
Right.
And significantly, if you translate that into English, the Kingdom of Aurania becomes the Kingdom of Heaven.
Ah, isn't that interesting, huh?
So here we have this new city-state being set up with a queen who's half Egyptian and half... a queen who's Egyptian and half Roman, and her children would have been half Persian. And of course, this is why, and I think it her daughter was in fact Mary the Virgin as we would know her. This is why the Persian magi, the Persian priests, would have come to see the birth of any child of this family, because potentially, of course, he was a prince of Persia.
Aha, so what you're saying here is that potentially the three magi, they were coming and going in every time a new child of this family was born. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, the magi were also the kingmakers. One of their roles, I mean, they were the astrologers and the priesthood of,
right,
of the Persians, but right, one of their roles was to discover the new king of Persia. Obviously, when a king dies, as Phraates IV did, there are many children to choose from, and it's up to the magi to divine the next rightful ruler of Persia.
Right.
One of the princes, obviously, they visited was Jesus, because he was half Persian and half Egyptian.
And how did the Persian Empire look at the time? Was this under the rule of Rome? I mean,
it was the biggest threat to Rome that there was, the Eastern Empire against Persia. Rome had lost three battles, and two of their emblems had been stolen by the Persians. They were the biggest threat to Rome at this time.
Mm.
Rome could not defeat Persia, and that is why Augustus wanted to seal his relationship with Persia and placate them by giving these diplomatic presents to Phraates IV. And one of the diplomatic presents was this so-called prostitute, who was the daughter of Cleopatra.
Right. So in this bloodline, then, so to speak, we have the merger of the Romans, the Egyptians, and the Persians, then, right?
Yes. Now, this rather makes Jesus a rather important prince, because essentially he is a prince of the three bloodlines of the three great empires.
He was a prince of Rome, he was a prince of Egypt, and he was a prince of Persia. So if he could find a throne to sit on, he could have been the king of the whole world, the whole of the known world. So, yes, what I'm saying is, he was an incredibly important person in that era, and he could have unified the entire known world. So, of course, he would have had a following who were trying to do just that.
Right.
Just like any promoters of any prince. You know, if they can actually put their prince on a throne, they become very important people as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would have had many backers, many rich and influential backers, who were trying to put him on the throne of not only Rome, but Persia as well. And this is what I think, this is where we come onto this new book that I've just written.
Right.
Not out yet. It should be out at the end of April. And it seems likely that the whole of the New Testament story is a story about a revolution, a battle against the Romans, because Jesus didn't want just the throne of Judea, because we know he became king of Judea, and that's quite implicit in the New Testament text that he became king. That's why they called him the King of the Jews, because he was.
Right.
There's a good quote here from Robert Graves, who's one of our eminent historians, or was,
right,
of the 20th century. And he says, "There need be no doubt that Jesus was anointed and crowned King of Israel, but the gospel editors have done their best to conceal this for political reasons, while referring to him as Christ and the Chosen One." Christ, of course, is not a religious title, it means king.
Right.
So does Messiah. The two titles, you know, we sort of view these titles as being somehow mystical or spiritual or something special. They're not, they just mean king, both of them.
They're political terms almost.
They're political terms, it just means king, the innocent one.
So
when we say Jesus Christ, what we're actually saying is King Jesus.
Right.
That was his title, that was his name.
Of course.
So he was a king of Judea. He was anointed as king of Judea, and he was anointed by Mary Magdalene. And this is why she was so important. And remember, we've just discussed before, Mary Magdalene was the richest woman in Judea. And also in my research, she was also Jesus' sister as well.
Well, okay, well, that's interesting because, I mean, what we're, you know, potentially could lead into here then is the idea of also of the bloodline, I guess, of Jesus Christ. I mean, this becomes important a little bit, I guess, today. Many people are looking into this and trying to figure out if there are descendants, so to speak, of this bloodline still to this day. Is this something that you touch upon at all?
I do, but there's not enough information that I found so far to actually trace that bloodline.
Right.
However, I believe, yes, there was a continuance of that bloodline. It's quite clear that they had children. One of them is mentioned in the Book of Acts, where Saul, that's Saul Josephus, actually blinds him. He's called Elymas, Ben-Jesus, Elymas, the son of Jesus. And it's quite clear that was one of the sons of Jesus. And there were several others as well. Sarah was one of the daughters. Their subsequent fate is unknown because there was a pogrom against all of the family of Jesus after this revolution failed. So some of them may well have been wiped out. But, I mean, this was a large, expanded family. I mean, Jesus had four brothers for a start. I mean, I don't know why the Christian church doesn't like to promote the fact that he had brothers and sisters.
Well, he was the son of God, that's why, you know, can only be one, right?
But this is a huge cover-up, isn't it?
Sure.
Christianity is all about the family, and the only family they won't tell us about is the family of Jesus.
Right, right.
So, you know, we all go through Christian education, and one of the most important things must be the names of Jesus' blood brothers. Hmm. So what were his brothers' names? Do you know them?
No, no idea. Well, I guess we could. I mean, I've heard about John, of course, and Mark possibly being one of them. I don't know.
No. It was
okay.
James, Jude, Joseph, and Simon.
Okay.
So his primary brother was James, who led the church supposedly after Jesus had died, but that's not quite true.
Okay.
So these were his brothers. They're named quite clearly in the New Testament. Everybody knows who they are in terms of theologians and people who study. But in terms of the laity who follow Christianity, they don't even know the names of the brothers of Jesus.
Right.
Why are they denied this information? Well, they're denied this information because there's a cover-up. Because if you look, if you suddenly realize that he had brothers, if you suddenly realize that his brothers were called James, Jude, Joseph, and Simon, you suddenly begin to realize that half of his disciples were actually his brothers.
Right.
Yeah? So it no longer becomes such a special story as they've been trying to tell us. Suddenly this becomes a clan story. This is a story about a family.
Right, exactly.
His main supporters were his brothers and sisters, because Mary and Martha were both of his sisters.
Mm-hmm.
So the very people who anointed him as king of Israel at the house in Bethany were his two sisters. It also becomes obvious that the lady he married was also his sister.
Mm.
Now, that might sound a bit odd. They'll be crying blasphemy from the tops of the steeples.
Of course, of course.
However, that was the custom. If
yeah.
you were in Egypt in this era, in fact, the whole of Egyptian history,
yeah.
it was the duty of the royal family to marry a close family member.
And yeah.
It was normally a daughter or a sister. All of the Ptolemies, the Greek Ptolemy pharaohs of Egypt, they all married daughters and sisters. Queen Cleopatra herself married two of her brothers,
mm-hmm.
although I think she had no issue from them, but nevertheless she married two of her brothers.
Mm.
It was a normal, in fact it was a duty, it wasn't a normal event, it was a duty to maintain the bloodline.
Right.
And so if Jesus was of the Egyptian royal line, which is pretty obvious because the New Testament and Josephus both call him the Egyptian false prophet, so it's quite obvious that he was of the Egyptian royal line, then he would have married his sister. That was the tradition. And so Mary Magdalene was his wife and his sister. And even within Judea, you know, King Agrippa, who was the king, first century king of Judea,
mm-hmm.
he married his sister as well, Berenice.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
It was part of the normal custom.
Right.
So, you know, this is the true history of the New Testament that they don't want you to know about, because it conflicts so greatly with what they're trying to teach us.
So, if we're taking this to account and think about it, this becomes an agenda of one family. This is a dynasty that is they're striving for the control of the earth. But what happened? I mean, they did not succeed.
They were a royal family without a throne to sit upon. Yeah. So they were exiled to this city-state, which I now say is Palmyra, which is a marvelous city on the borders of Syria and Persia.
Okay.
And suddenly, Palmyra was a village. It's an oasis in the middle of nowhere. It's in a desert between the Euphrates and Syria.
Mm-hmm.
It is utterly barren except for this one little tiny oasis, which was used obviously as a caravan stop between Syria and Persia. And suddenly, in the first century, this little village on this oasis became a vast Roman city.
Mm. Why?
How? Where did the money come from? Well, it seems quite obvious to me that the money came from Queen Thea Musa Aurania, who was the Queen of Persia, who was booted out of Persia in AD 4.
Mm.
And incidentally, she was kicked out of Persia because she married her brother. No, correction, she married her son.
There we go.
Again, the Egyptian tradition.
Mm.
And Josephus makes it quite clear that this was not a Persian tradition at all. So this was, again, the Egyptian tradition. She married her son, and they kicked her out of Persia.
Hmm.
And suddenly, this oasis village in the middle of nowhere suddenly sprouts into an enormous great Roman city. And that was on the back of the royalty who fled to that city when they were kicked out of Persia.
Hmm.
Now, in my first book, I wrote that they probably were evicted from Persia and were relatively poor, etc.
Mm.
But quite apparent, actually, from my later research, that when they went out of Persia, they must have taken with them half of the Persian treasury as well.
Really?
Huh. So they were not short of a few shekels, that's for sure. And it was this treasury, this enormous great wealth of Persia, that paid for this enormous great city in the middle of nowhere, the city of the desert.
Palmyra, and so they were trying to set this up as the world headquarters, so to speak?
Yes. This was going to be the new world headquarters, and
right.
From here you needed to launch a bid, firstly for the throne of Judea, which they succeeded with, although not entirely succeeded, because obviously a lot of Judeans didn't go along with it.
Mm.
But the next target was the throne of Rome. So what Jesus was looking for was to become the next emperor.
Mm.
And that was what the Jewish revolt was all about. He was trying to start a revolution that started in Judea, but would roll along the entire Roman Empire so that he would end up as emperor of Rome.
Right.
Now, all of this, we have to restage this a little bit later, because obviously the biblical texts seem to say that Jesus was crucified in AD 33. Well, it doesn't, actually. There is nothing within the New Testament that actually gives you the presence of Pontius Pilate gives you some clue, but that is, there are alternative sections in the New Testament which give you an alternate date for the crucifixion.
Okay.
You read the equivalent components within Josephus' story. Every single item in the New Testament, in the real historical story from Josephus and from the Roman historian, each event takes place in the AD 60s, not the AD 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So this story that we have in the New Testament is completely at odds with the historical references that it's trying to actually point towards, except for the presence of Pontius Pilate. He's about the only exception. So this entire story actually happened in the AD 60s.
Okay.
This is when Jesus became High Priest of Jerusalem, and he did. It's in the historical record.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus of Gamala became High Priest in AD 63. So all of these events happened in the AD 60s, during the run-up to the Jewish Civil War. And it was to be this Jewish Civil War that was going to roll across the whole of Rome and place Jesus upon the throne of Rome.
Right.
The reason for this was because the throne of Rome was empty. Nero had just died.
So this was a perfect opportunity, so to speak, too.
It was a perfect opportunity. There was unrest in Rome. The three emperors came and went within the space of 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
The throne was vacant. It was open to whoever could claim it. And the primary primary oracle that was circulating the Roman Empire at the time was the star prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And the star prophecy said that a star from the east would become the ruler of the world.
Hmm.
And of course, the star from the east was Jesus himself. This is why we have the story of the star over the nativity scene.
Right.
When Jesus was born, the star of Bethlehem. Jesus was the star from the east. And the oracle said that the star from the east would become the ruler of the whole world.
Hmm.
And this was a widely circulating oracle that was reported by Josephus and several of the other Roman historians at the time.
Mm.
And it's quite clear that Jesus was using this oracle as a springboard to become emperor of Rome.
And who put down this prophecy?
Vespasian.
Mm.
And of course, Vespasian was a nobody. He was just an army commander.
Okay.
Now, he put down the Jewish revolt with the Roman legions, of course.
Okay.
And it was Vespasian who used, courtesy of our friend Saul Josephus, who used the star prophecy to become emperor of Rome, because Vespasian was a nobody. He was a tax collector. In fact, just as most of the biblical disciples were tax collectors. That's why we see this reference to tax collectors all the way through the New Testament.
Hmm.
In the New Testament, they tend to call them publicans, but the publicanus was a tax collector. And this is why Jesus was associated with tax collectors and sinners.
Mm-hmm.
This is a constant refrain within the New Testament.
Right, right.
So Vespasian was just a commoner. He did not have the royal authority that Jesus had. And so he used the star prophecy as one of the methods of getting the throne of Rome.
Right, right.
He said he was the star from the east because he fought this battle. In the east, of course, he fought it in Judea. So he said, you know, I'm the star from the east.
Hmm.
But of course, it wasn't his oracle at all. It was a reference to Jesus. He was the one who was supposed to become emperor of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems likely. So again, we're saying that this happened in AD 60 and the siege of Rome in AD 70. So the crucifixion actually occurred in AD 70.
AD 70, okay.
Yeah. Occurred in AD 70.
And what happened here then? I mean, was it...
Well, we have another reference to this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is the beauty of making this link between Saul and Josephus, because we get all of these new texts about the life of Jesus. Because, you know, Saul was some sort of commander who was opposing the Christians or the proto-Christians.
Okay.
And rounding them up and putting them in prison. Now, it doesn't ever say in the New Testament under what authority Saul was able to do this.
Hmm.
But as Josephus, of course, he was in a position to do exactly this because Josephus was the army commander in control of Galilee.
Right.
And so, of course, he could round them up and put them into prison because he was the army commander in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the main characters that he was actually trying to oppose was Jesus of Gamala. And the question is, who was this Jesus of Gamala? Well, he just has to be the biblical Jesus,
mm-hmm.
because Jesus of Gamala was the army commander in command of 600 rebel fishermen. Now, who was the commander of rebel fishermen in this era? Now, come on.
Yeah.
There is only one such person, and that was Jesus, because the symbol of Christianity, as we know, is the fish.
Right.
And he was the fisher of men, and...
The fisher king, and yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's yeah. Right. He became the fisher king. This is when we start coming on to the Arthurian legend.
Mm.
So, all of this happened in the late AD 60s. This is when Saul Josephus was active as army commander.
Mm.
And it ended up with the siege of Jerusalem, the destruction of Jerusalem. And then Josephus, our Saul, then goes on to relate the aftermath of the destruction of Jerusalem. And he tells this story about coming back from Tekoa, which is a town to the south of Jerusalem. And what does he find there, just as he comes through, before he gets to the gate, is three acquaintances of his being crucified.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this image of three crosses.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a man called Josephus of Arimathea, who comes across these people being crucified. He takes pity on them. He has people asking him for clemency. And so he goes to the governor of Jerusalem, the new governor, and asks for clemency and gets them taken down off the cross.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Similar story?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Very similar story.
Yeah.
And so they take them down off the cross. Two of them die, only one survives.
There we go. Mm.
Yeah. Similar story.
Yeah, now, but what you're saying here, though, is that this was not Jesus of Gamala hanging up there on the cross, you know?
Yes, it was.
It was, okay. Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure it was. It doesn't actually say it was Jesus of Gamala, but the people on the cross were three, obviously, of the commanders who had been defending Jerusalem during the siege.
Okay.
And we know that the names of the primary commanders were John of Gischala, Jesus of Gamala, and Johann So it had to be one of those three, didn't it?
Okay.
I'm basically assuming that the one that survived was Jesus of Kamala. And he was the guy who survived.
And
now, this is the biblical story. This is the biblical story of the crucifixion. But this,
right.
of course, happened in AD 70, after the fall of Jerusalem.
And this story that you're talking about here, this is mainly then from Josephus or Saul, right?
Yeah, this is from Saul, equating Saul with Josephus. So we're marrying the two texts together.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do so, you find that the biblical texts are the same as Saul's texts. You know, if you read Acts, Acts assumes that you have read Josephus, because all of the references come from Josephus. If you read the rest of the Synoptic Gospels, most of the parables that come out of there come out of Josephus. They are not identical, they are slightly distorted. Josephus gives the historical story, and then the New Testament says a parable based on that same story.
Mm-hmm.
So, Josephus will... No, let's do it first with the New Testament. The New Testament will give a story about an absentee landlord that sends his servants to go and get money from the farmer.
Okay.
You know, why Jesus should be so interested in absentee landlords, it doesn't really say. There you go. He was very pro-absentee landlords getting money from farmers.
Right, right.
So he sends his servants to go and get the money, and the farmer is unimpressed with this and kills them. And he kills the next one as well.
Okay.
And then he sends his son, and the farmer kills the absentee landlord's son. And then we have a story about Jesus sending out the 70 disciples to go and spread the word. Now, if you read Josephus, he gives exactly the same story, but in historical context. And the historical context is the king trying to send to one of his prime ministers of Agrippa II, trying to get this guy to give his money, basically. And he does the same. He kills the first one, he kills the second one. And then on the third occasion, they send out 70 representatives to go and get the money from this chap.
There we go.
It's the same story, but the 70 being sent out are no longer disciples. They're, in fact, they are tax collectors.
Tax collectors, yeah.
This is all about the...
It's all about the money.
A remnant of taxes within Judea. I mean, it's a
right.
common problem, isn't it?
Right.
It's the same in our era. Things never change. But the main problem, the thing that was used to spark the revolt, because everybody needs a reason to start a war. You know, people don't go to war lightly. They want a good reason for doing so, and the good reason was taxes. Because when Theodosia Urania, the queen of Persia, was exiled to Palmyra and Gamala, it was promised to her and her descendants that the lands that they would inherit would be tax-free. The quid pro quo was that if they could have tax-free lands on the borders between Rome and Persia, they could have it tax-free as long as they policed these lands. So they would be like a buffer state between the armies of Persia and Rome.
Okay.
Because there had been so many wars between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this huge great army stuck on the deserts between Syria and Persia. And so they were tax-free, so they could obviously fund their own armed forces. Now, the Romans had decided to end this tradition. They wanted to tax Palmyra.
And this opened up very... this is when people began to become upset, obviously, about this.
That's right. This is the spark that formed the Jewish revolt.
Because
suddenly they were going to be taxed.
But what this also means is, though, that this is was also a good opportunity then for Jesus of Gamala to start his revolt, right?
That's right. He used it as one of the pretexts.
Right.
We can't have this, you know. we've been promised this land tax-free. Why should we pay Roman taxes? And this is why we have all these references in the New Testament to, to taxes. You know, this is why Jesus had to say, you know, when he was confronted, will you pay this tax? And he says, pay unto Caesar what is due to Caesar, and pay unto God what is due to God. This is what it was all about. It was all about taxes. This is why he was consorting with tax collectors and sinners. So it was a tax revolt, but it was more than a tax revolt, because they were using this tax revolt in order to put forward their claimant to the throne of Rome.
Right.
So he wanted, on the back of this, to go and become emperor of Rome. He failed, and they were crucified. However, we have this story where Josephus, the historian, finds these people on crosses and has them taken down. Of course, in the New Testament, the person who does exactly the same event was Josephus of Arimathea.
Right.
So here we have a story where they were actually taken down, and one of them survived, and this was Jesus. So what happened to him after he survived the crucifixion?
Right, right.
Well,
that's the...
strange as it is, we have this very strange account within the annals of Rome. Now, this is going back to Tacitus and Suetonius, of a strange meeting between Vespasian and an unknown Egyptian prince. Now, as we said before, Vespasian was only a commoner, and this was a very religious era. You didn't just jump onto a throne if you did not have an oracle. You had to have some reason why the gods thought that you should be able to take the throne of Rome. And Vespasian did not have that. But, you know, all his accolades were hailing him as emperor of Rome. But he was very, very reticent. He refused to go to Rome for over a year after he'd been acclaimed emperor.
Okay.
Because he did not have an oracle. And the oracle he got was from some strange chap who came to him, who was probably called the Egyptian prince, who was lame, he couldn't stand, who had dislocated shoulders, and was blind in one eye.
Jesus.
And the followers of Vespasian got Vespasian to cure this man's blindness by using the same techniques as were used for Jesus when Jesus was doing his miracles. So it was a reverse miracle performed on this invalid, which now was the oracle that he could take to Rome and say, now I'm the emperor.
Okay, yeah.
Why would this event give him a good oracle that this was, you know, the blessing of the gods? And it seems quite clear to me that this was a reverse miracle.
Right.
This person who was injured, could not stand, had dislocated shoulders, was obviously Jesus himself.
Right, right. And this is what...
He'd been brought before Vespasian, who was in Alexandria at the time, to give his blessing, as it were, upon Vespasian. Because Jesus was the guy who had all of the oracles. He was the royal prince. He was the guy who was anointed. And they wanted to transfer all of those good omens upon Vespasian.
Okay.
And the way they did it was to bring this guy before Vespasian and say, look, if Vespasian can perform a miracle on you and cure your blindness, then surely Vespasian must be a greater prince than you. He must have the oracle.
Okay.
And you don't, because Vespasian, you know, can do it to you.
That's interesting.
So he used Jesus's miracle techniques of spitting in someone's eye to cure his blindness.
There we go.
Yeah. And this, I believe, was a meeting between Vespasian and Jesus after the fall of Jerusalem.
Okay.
In late AD 70, in about late August, early September.
So we're, Ralph, we're coming up, you know, so to speak, to what is going to happen to Jesus, his consequent, I guess, either exile or something similar to England, and that is something that we definitely want to get into. But what we have to do now is to take a little break here, because we're running out of time in our first segment. But we're going to continue our discussion and lead us through here, so to speak. But before we do that, though, I do want to talk a little bit about your appearance on the upcoming conference, the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool, England. This is the 3rd and 4th of May, so this is definitely something for our British and European friends out there who want to see Ralph Ellis, and there's more fine fellow researchers that will be attending the conference, like David Hatcher-Childress, Jerry E. Smith, Marcus Allen, Michael Tessarion, Ken Thomas, Ian Crane, and David Griffin. It's going to be a very exciting event, and I want to mention the website here that you could pop over to, write up that and bookmark and take a look. There's much more information for you there about this event. The website is beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Again, that's beyond-knowledge.co.uk, and there you can see where you can buy tickets and so forth and much more information. Ralph, tell us a little bit about your appearance there and what you're going to be talking about on the conference.
Well, I should be there on the Saturday afternoon, I think, for the Saturday, and it'll be an hour and a half, I think. I've slightly changed it. It said originally that I was going to be talking about Solomon, but I've been persuaded to put together a presentation about the new book. So this will be a presentation on the Jesus book.
Ah, fascinating. And leading into King Arthur, I guess, then, also?
Yes, indeed, leading into King Arthur. So it should have lots of pictures of Syria and Jerusalem. And I should be performing one of Jesus' miracles as well.
Really? Okay.
On stage.
That sounds interesting. Worth checking out for sure. Definitely. Yeah, so again, I mean, head on over to the website there. It's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Myself and Fredrik is going to be there as well. We'll not do any talk there, but we definitely want to meet up with some of the folks there and listen to all these fine speakers to talk about their research and so forth. So that's going to be very interesting. Do check it out. Looking forward to that very much. Okay, so Ralph, let's do like this. Tell us shortly about your own website and some of the books that you have on there for us and your new one, and then we'll take a short break.
Okay, well, the website is www.edfu-books.com. So that's the official site for Ralph Ellis, and it's got various bits of information on there, and obviously it's got details for all the books. So I think there's six, if I remember correctly, in the religious series now. So that starts with Jesus Last of the Pharaohs. Goes on to Tempest and Exodus, which is obviously about the Exodus. Then we have Eden in Egypt, which is basically saying that obviously the Genesis story was actually located in Egypt, and Adam and Eve were in fact Nefertiti and Akhenaten. Then we have Solomon, Falcon of Sheba, which is a I still think it's one of my best, although it's not the best seller, I have to say, but mm-hmm. I think it's one of the best of the books, which is Solomon, Falcon of Sheba, is the discovery of the tombs of King Solomon and King David and the Queen of Sheba, which I think is a fascinating story because it wraps up the whole of the United Monarchy into one book and placing the whole of that history back into Egyptian history.
Wow.
And it just works so well. It's absolutely fantastic. So that's one of my favorites.
Right.
And then we go on to Cleopatra to Christ, which is, as we've been speaking about, saying that Jesus was the great-grandson of Queen Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
And then we come on to the final book, which is to be published late April, perhaps early May by the time it gets here, because it's being printed in America. And that is King Jesus. From Cam to Camelot. And Cam, of course, is the ancient name of Egypt.
Mm, Chem, yeah, now the coin drops down, so to speak.
Yes, right, that's the ancient name of Egypt.
Right.
So Camelot was based on the name for Egypt.
Chem, yeah, there we go. Well, very interesting. And this, it seems too that your series is, you know, it's following chronologically order in regards to time. Is that right?
Pretty much. Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs, which is the first of the books, is a bit of a synopsis of the whole of the Bible. So it starts with Genesis and it goes all the way through to the New Testament.
Mm.
I wrote that as a book which was going to be the final book. But of course it turned out not to be the final book at all. It was just the start.
Right.
So then I've gone back and done each separate segment of the Bible separately. So Eden in Egypt covers the Genesis story. Solomon, Falcon of Sheba covers Kings and Chronicles, which is the united monarchy of King Solomon.
Mm.
Tempest and Exodus covers the Exodus story. And then, of course, Cleopatra to Christ goes on and in discovers lots of things about the New Testament, as does the final book, King Jesus, which is obviously pretty much all on the New Testament story.
Right. So do stay with us as we'll go further into the story of the crucified Jesus, the reverse miracle by Vespian, and also, of course, how this is leading up to the connection with the Arthurian legend or the story of King Arthur. So it's going to be very interesting hearing the continuation of this. But in the meantime, though check out the websites edfu-books.com and for the Beyond Knowledge Conference, that's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Ralph, stay with us and we'll be right back.
Thank you.